Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Sooners Extra Twitter space / podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on a Wednesday afternoon. Sorry about the scheduling issue earlier. This is Ryan Aber, joined by Justin Martinez and columnists Jenny Carlson and Barry Trammell, here to talk a little bit about OU football, and especially the game Saturday against Baylor. Jenny, we'll start with you, since you weren't with us in Ames on Saturday. We've seen Oklahoma's season turn a little bit around with these last couple wins. Looked like their defense played a whole lot better on Saturday, at least. How much better do you get the sense this defense is now versus the one we saw during the three-game losing streak?
I mean, I think this week's going to be very telling. Beating Kansas and beating Iowa State, obviously, coming into both of those games, you could have seen the Sooners losing both. You know, we didn't know about Dylan Gabriel's situation coming into Kansas. How would he play? How healthy would he be? How much, you know, rust would he show after being out? And then the question of, would the defense be able to show some signs of improvement? Those were all in the affirmative. But still, we see that, you know, it looks like Kansas and Iowa State are going to finish towards the bottom of the Big 12. So, you know, Baylor, a team that isn't having the season that a lot of people expected, frankly, probably they expected after winning the Big 12 championship a year ago, but still a very capable team, and a team that, you know, if things fall right, they'll be towards the top of the league, towards the top half of the league, at least. So I think there's still a question. It looks to me like the Sooner defense is more organized. So that's a positive sign. I think that was one of the big faults that we saw during that three-game losing streak, just guys looking completely out of place and confused about who's supposed to do what. So being more organized is no small thing for this defense. And I think having Billy Bowman back has been significant. If he can continue to ramp up his snaps, I think that's a huge development for the Sooner defense. But I think a lot's going to be determined in the coming weeks. You know, obviously Baylor this week, I don't know if at West Virginia is seen as a major test, but the Mountaineers can definitely score, and that's going to be a stress on the defense. And then obviously Bedlam and Texas Tech to finish out, you know, teams again that have shown the ability to score. So I think these next few weeks will be extremely telling for just how much better the Sooner defense is.
Justin, when we look at the improvement of the OU defense, what to you will be most telling when it comes to Saturday's game, as far as an area that you're really looking to see improvement that shows that this isn't just the fact that they've gone against especially an Iowa State offense that had no punch on the ground, but what do you look for to show that there's improvement on the defense outside of just total yardage and obviously the scoreboard?
Yeah, I think just the ability to get pressure on the quarterback, you know, that's kind of been an ongoing thing because they haven't been able to get sacks. They barely got their first one in conference play against Iowa State last weekend, which is obviously in a step in the right direction. But, you know, you'd be looking for them to be able to really get it going up front, because at the end of the day, that's where it all starts. So, I mean, they progressed in that department against Iowa State. You know, they had, I believe it was four quarterback hurries, and like we said, the sack as well. But it's going to be a real test against Baylor. I mean, they've got a veteran offensive line. They've got multiple seniors up front there. So I think that's probably going to be the most telling thing, is just how are they going to start off down in the trenches there?
Yeah. And Barry, you know, I look at Justin mentioned this Baylor offensive line. They are really experienced. a veteran group, and behind them, they've got a freshman running back in Richard Reese, who's just been fantastic of late, especially almost 800 yards rushing, averaging a touch over 5 yards a carry. In your mind, do you feel like, one, that defensive line is starting to perform a little bit better, and two, are they going to be able to figure out ways to you know, slow down that Baylor running game and Richard Reese specifically?
No, I don't really see a lot of optimism for any kind of recent performance on the defensive line. Iowa State's the worst offense in the Big 12. So I think you sort of are what you are at this point. We're two-thirds of the way through the season. I think Baylor's a pretty tough test. Shapen's a pretty good quarterback. You talked about the line. Reese and the other guys, I mean, Baylor's got playmakers, and they're a big, tough team. I think the Sooners are going to have to outscore Baylor to win this game. I don't know that Sooners can go in there and say, hey, we're going to beat them 24-21 or 28-20. I mean, I think Baylor's going to get north of 30, and I think to stay in the game, the Sooners are going to have to do the same.
And going back to you, Jenny, flipping over to that offensive side, you know, we saw, you know, sort of the opposite there when you talk about the numbers that the OU offense put up on Saturday versus the defense. Dylan Gabriel, not the best game that he's had numbers-wise, less than 150 yards passing, but fairly efficient there, made some good decisions. You know, what to you is the key for OU's offense against a Baylor defense that has a lot of talent over there?
Yeah, let's remember too that, you know, obviously that Iowa State defense is, you know, no joke. They're able to limit a lot of teams, and you know, they've had their times when you know, Texas got some points rolled up on them, but I think that's a very capable defense. So you know, I think that's definitely a tip of the cap to the Cyclones and what they're able to do defensively. But I think against Baylor, you know, the Baylor defensive line, you were talking about the Baylor offensive line, the Baylor defensive line is very, very good. So they're going to have to have one of their best games. That offensive line is managing that Baylor front. You know, we've seen a lot of really good things out of the OU offensive line. And to me, you know, other than maybe Eric Gray and the way he's exceeded a lot of expectations, I think that offensive line has as well. So I think to have success, you want to see that offensive line clear the way for the running game, obviously protect Dylan Gabriel. But, you know, I think if they can clear some space for Eric Gray to get out in space, you know, that's going to be huge because, you know, Gray is really effective. He's been really good for them. So in the same way that Iowa State's going to want to get their running game going, I think Oklahoma's running game offensively is going to be pretty darn important.
Yeah, and Justin, the Sooners right now, number nine in the league in sacks allowed. They've allowed 17, pretty big gap there to 10th between 17 and 30 for Texas Tech. But Baylor's defense has gotten after it. 17 sacks for them for 113 yards. They're fourth in the Big 12, I believe. How big of a test is this for Oklahoma's offensive line? In one, protecting Dylan Gabriel, but two, continuing to open up space for Eric Gray in that running game the way that they've done so well over these last few weeks.
Yeah, it's a big test, like you mentioned. I mean, they've got plenty of guys up front. Baylor does, Gabe Hall being the biggest one. He's got 3.5 sacks on the season. They've even got linebackers that have managed to create a lot of pressure as well. So, I mean, it's going to be a tough test, but I mean, if there was going to be a tough test for a certain group that you feel good about, the offensive line for OU has been one of the more consistent groups for the team this entire season, one of the few ones that has continued to improve. So I think you got to feel good at least in what you've been seeing out of the offensive line. And then you look at guys that they're protecting. I mean, Eric Gray's done a good job of just making people miss, kind of making something out of nothing. Dylan Gabriel has showed a lot more patience, composure as well lately. So it's going to be a tough test for sure. But I mean, from what you've seen lately, it seems like like specifically in the offensive line, the group has been doing a pretty good job so far.
Yeah, they really have. I think Anton Harrison has been really good over there. You know, it's interesting the way that they've used Robert Conjo the last couple of weeks has come on to replace McKay Matower, a little bit of shared duties there at one of the guard spots. But outside of that, they've been really consistent with that group since Wanya Morris came back in. But Barry, I want to ask you about another one of OU's offensive weapons that we've seen really be up and down lately, and that's Marvin Mims. We've seen him be, you know, fantastic at times, but has disappeared in others. Just had the one catch for minus 2 yards against Texas. Of course, that was a big part of that was the fact that they didn't have anybody to get him the ball, but just had a couple catches for 16 yards against Iowa State, had a couple of drops, and is really been a lot of peaks and valleys for him. How important is it for the Sooners to get him going on Saturday, even with the success that Eric Gray's had on the ground, and especially the success that Jahlil Farouk has had starting to find a bigger and bigger role in this offense?
I think it's pretty clear that Mims is either beat up or injured on some level. He's not playing anywhere near as well as he has in the past. What that means for the Sooners is, I don't know. It's not as deep of a receiving room as everybody once thought. Farouk is playing very well and has turned into a playmaker. That's very good. But, you know, Theo Weiss is sort of a forgotten guy. Drake Stoops, you always have. But I think the Sooners need Mims fairly badly. And they're not going to be as top of flight, not as good on offense as they could be until he gets back in the groove. So I think that's something to keep an eye on going forward is his explosiveness, his playmaking. Without that, you know, Dylan Gabriel's offense becomes much more limited.
Yeah, it certainly does. You mentioned Theo Weiss. He didn't have any catches on Saturday against Iowa State. Just has let's see, what is this? 15 catches this year. So certainly hasn't been the kind of playmaker that he's shown to be in the past. But Jahlil Farouk has been really good. Was their leading rusher. Or not their leading rusher, their second leading rusher, I should say, on Saturday in Iowa State. He's got 20 catches, 269 yards, a couple of touchdowns, has had some really big plays, and really they found different ways to use him in the offense. Jenny, we've seen some experimentation with Jahlil Farouk offensively, but also a couple different things from Jeff Lebby lately. What do you think about the way that Jeff Lebby has mixed things up with this offense? It seems like it's you know, he's trying to be creative and do some different things to try to break them out.
Yeah, and you know, I think it you know, clearly when Dylan Gabriel was injured, it was forced creativity. You know, they had to look around for some different options, and they did. I mean, I think finding a few guys that you could direct snap it to, wildcat it to, I think that was huge, because now they have seen some different maybe abilities and skill sets that weren't, I mean, not to say you didn't know that, Braden Willis could catch it and move around and run over some guys. But, you know, I think it gives you some different ideas about what may be possible. So I think that is probably the spark for what we're seeing now. And I'm not saying that if Dylan Gabriel doesn't get hurt, that they don't do those things and add some of those twists and some of the things we're seeing, but that sure didn't, I think that opened a door to some things that it'll be interesting to see, you know, obviously the rest of the year what they do, but then, you know, what does that look like moving forward? Do they maybe do more unconventional things with some players that, you know, in coming seasons as they, you know, look to, you know, be as multidimensional as they can on offense? I just think it's an interesting jumping off point that, you know, obviously nobody wanted to see Dylan Gabriel get hurt, and that definitely changed the whole tenor of the season. But if it, you know, it does have a positive, maybe it is that some of these other guys are worked into the offense in creative ways. And is that something moving forward that Jeff Lebby does in the future? I think it's worth watching.
Yeah, it certainly will be. It really has been interesting watching some of the different things that he's done with that offense, not only with Jahlil Farouk and some of the Wildcat stuff that they've done, but, you know, did a lot of putting guys in motion on Saturday. We saw it with Drake Stoops. We saw it with Gavin Freeman quite a bit. Justin, and one thing that was interesting in that Iowa State game was, and I wrote about this in Monday's paper, was the line change that OU pulled off, rolling in 8 new players for a series. It was just 3 plays, just real quick, but was interesting to see, one, the philosophy of doing that change, moving that many guys out, especially replacing everybody on the offensive line except for Andrew Raim at center, and getting some younger players a chance to be on the field in meaningful snaps. And really, it seemed like put them in good position to have some success just with 3 plays. Those were sort of scripted out by Jeff Lebby. But do you anticipate this becoming a regular thing? And how can something like that help the Sooners, you know, whether it's on the field with success in those plays specifically, or developing some of those younger guys to have an impact later this year?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been an ongoing thing for us this season, is kind of talking about when is it time to start to look a little bit to the future, you know, on some of these younger guys and give them some more opportunities. And I mean, I don't mind it, especially if it's just for short bursts, to put them in there, let them get some experience. So that way maybe they're not as shell-shocked when they have to get thrown in, or if they have to get thrown in due to an injury or something like that. And yeah, I mean, the guys who came in were guys that definitely there's some intrigue around them. I mean, look at guys like LV Bunkley Shelton, who got in there. I mean, he did some nice things at Arizona State. Gavin Freeman and Jaden Gibson. Freeman has had a few really big plays whenever he has gotten touches. And then Jaden Gibson has the size and that makes him sort of an intriguing guy. Jason Llewellyn as well. So, yeah, I mean, these are guys that definitely have some potential and are going to need some reps in order to reach that potential. So to bring them out them for some short bursts like that, I think it's definitely beneficial moving forward.
And Barry, can you ever remember something like that happening where, you know, they rolled out that many new guys just for a short burst like that?
No, it's sort of a novel concept. I'm intrigued by the wholesale nature of it. I mean, it's what receivers and running backs, they get platooned all the time. Offensive linemen, not so much. If you're going to do that, I was intrigued why you do it with an entire line, sans the center. I don't know why you wouldn't mix and match throughout the quarter or something. But it obviously worked pretty good, so I find it interesting. I'm also reminded of last season when Alex Grinch's defense got constantly criticized for not playing his best players enough. You know, Winfrey and Benito and Isaiah Thomas, that crowd would play, I don't know, 70% of the snaps, 75% of the snaps. People say, why aren't these guys playing more? You know, I think it's a legitimate question now. You know, the Thunder, this is not Thunder. This is not building for the future. They're not trying to get a good draft pick. You know, developing young players is good. Beating Iowa State is paramount, though. So I found the philosophy a little strange, but it worked, so you can't criticize something that works.
Yeah, 3 plays, 29 yards, got a couple first downs out of it, and then got them off the field. I think the biggest thing for them is that they found a few plays. They had a little swing pass over there to Eric Gray out of the backfield, a jet sweep play with Gavin Freeman, and then a Gabriel Keeper. I think that they found a few plays that they felt good about, both with their chances to have success against what Iowa State was doing defensively, and also with the guys that they rolled out there on the field to give them, you know, a little bit of momentum, a little bit of feel good, and then get them off there and, you know, get those other guys in, and certainly wind up working out all right. They did have to do a fake field goal there to score a touchdown on that drive, but they still did score. So I'm not sure we're going to see it every game. We saw a version of it against TCU, didn't include the offensive line in that one. But it's not going to surprise me if it pops up, you know, one or two more times during the season. But, you know, Jenny, when we look at this team overall, you know, we talk about those offensive players who were on the field for that drive. Brent Venables talked about, you know, the ongoing conversation about red shirts and things like that. We saw some more young players on the field for significant snaps on Saturday. You know, Gentry Williams, Robert Spears Jennings again. You know, once again, Robert Mason Thomas, or R. Mason Thomas, excuse me. Any of those guys do you think are going to play bigger and bigger roles here down the stretch than they have to this point?
I mean, it seems possible, right? Because, I mean, there were some guys that, you know, there was a point in the year where, you know, guys like Kip Lewis and Jaron Kanak and that crew, you know, oh, they're not ready, they're not going to play. And then, you know, before you know it, they're seeing more and more time. So I definitely think that's a possibility. I thought it was interesting, you know, anymore, or at least in recent years, it's felt like the idea of redshirting guys has become almost not a non-starter, but something you don't hear a lot about. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of redshirting going on the last few years at OU. I've even had conversations with Mike Gundy up at OSU about redshirting, and he kind of says, you know, it's really like if a guy's at all capable, there's a limited chance of redshirting. They're just going to play guys because I think any more coaches see the portal. They see, you know, obviously a short 3 years before a guy could declare for the NFL, whether he's ready or not, he can do it. So, you know, they're sort of working on a limited time clock. And so I thought it was interesting to hear Brent talking about redshirting guys to start with earlier this year, but then as he talked about it earlier this week, you know, talking about potentially as they build up positions, if they've had to play guys early, possibly redshirting them in the future as older players. And that really is something we don't see a lot of. So I think it's all fascinating because, you know, this is not, even though we know Brent Venables from his earlier days at OU, we don't know him as a head coach and we don't know him as intimately in the last decade as a coordinator and how he's operated. So to sort of have some things come up where you're like, oh, maybe that's how things will go now. It's just been interesting to sort of hear the differences and, you know, whether it works out or not, I have no idea. He's obviously had to change plans on who he thought would play to start with, some of those younger guys. So anything's possible, but I did think it was interesting to hear him talking about how he's used red shirts in the past, how he could use them at OU. And to me, that opens the door wide to a lot of different scenarios, potentially, for young guys and, frankly, guys that are maybe a little bit older on the roster as time goes on.
Yeah. What about you, Barry? What did you make of that and what Brent Venables had to say about, you know, that process and going through it and thinking that through here near the end of the season?
Well, I think coaches, by and large, have been a little slow to come to grips with this, but they're learning. Redshirting is becoming more of a it's two things. A guy is just completely not ready to play. Can't put him on the field. Or when guys get hurt and you have to sit there and wonder about, you know, are they going to be able to get in five games? Look at what's even before the transfer portal, redshirting was becoming less of a deal because if a player turned out to be a pretty good player, a really good player, you might have him only three seasons anyway because he's going to jump to the draft as quick as he can. Now with the portal, basically, you're not assured that that player's future is yours. So this idea of saving him for 2026 or 2025, that's not a very smart strategy. If a guy can help you, or if a guy could benefit from playing, I think more and more coaches are realizing it's sort of like what Jacko said about Gundy. You just got to play guys. When it's time to play, if you need them or they can play, you got to play. The red shirting thing is becoming sort of passe very, very quickly.
Yeah, and Barry, I think that's most illustrated by the offensive line, where generally offensive linemen aren't ready to go as freshmen. So a lot of times those guys have gotten redshirted unless they're forced to roll into the starting lineup. You know, we saw who was it, Drew Samia, I think, started as a freshman. It's been, I was going to say, a few years ago. It's been more than a few years ago at this point. But, you know, guys like Jacob Sexton, who's played in six games, and Jake Taylor, who's played in six. Each of those guys were part of that rotation that we talked about earlier on the offensive line. Those are guys that I think would have been redshirted without any doubt in the past. And now they're, finding their way on the field for more games than that redshirt rule allows.
Yeah, I don't know if you were asking me to respond, but this is a case of, for so long, this goes for a lot of things in college football. For so long, there was a set way of doing things. Heck, even when they went to this 4-game limit, if you stayed under 5 games, you could redshirt. I remember we had the staff meeting at the paper, and we decided this would be a cool thing. We'll count freshmen's, particularly freshman games, and a running count for seeing when you can't redshirt anymore. Well, turns out a much bigger factor on that 5-game or that 4-game limit is not freshmen. It's veterans who might decide, you know what, I think I may just, after 4 games, the season's not going great, maybe I'll just pull out and not play anymore. We saw that with Jalen McCleskey up at OSU a few years ago. We saw that with the Houston quarterback, whose name escapes me now, but he ended up transferring to Miami. And you're seeing guys that are sort of out looking out for their own careers in terms of the future, much more than the team future for what the team that they're on. So sometimes things change so quickly in college football, particularly with this portal and NIL and all the things everybody knows about, that we just don't know what are the motivations anymore. And sometimes we can be stuck in the old thought process that's really meaningless. Like I said, to me, the whole red shirting question is this: can a guy help you now? Can he play at all? And that's, you can't worry about it much beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, De'Aaron King, I think, was the quarterback.
That's him. That's him.
Think about. Yeah. Jenny, let's turn our attention to the college football playoff ranking that came out on Tuesday night. Figure if we're going to wait a day, we might as well address what happened on Tuesday night, even though this one, unlike most of them, hasn't involved OU, but what did you make of the way that the top of the rankings shook out, particularly where TCU fell at number 7?
And don't you guys think that if TCU had on OU helmets or Texas helmets or Alabama helmets that they'd be in the top 4? I mean, I think we can all agree that they've got a resume that if they were wearing one of those blue blood brands, running around in those jerseys and helmets, that their ranking would be higher than that. Last night, the committee chairman talked about them getting behind in games. Hey, guess what? You ranked them behind teams that not only got behind, but lost. So TCU not losing, I mean, being undefeated, beating 4 ranked teams during that undefeated run, I mean, they're not one of the blue bloods. But if you look at the resume and strip away the name, to me, there's no question they should be ranked higher than they currently are at number 7.
Well, I feel called out, Jenny, because I do vote in the top 25, and I've actually got TCU at number 8 right now, between a couple of one-loss
teams,
Alabama and Oregon. I understand your point, but to me, the fact that TCU has played a couple of those close games against teams that, you know, maybe they shouldn't have been as close with, particularly the West Virginia game there. It was really close there until TCU scored a touchdown there at the end. And with the resumes that Alabama and Oregon now, I'm not going to argue that Alabama probably wouldn't get the grace that they've gotten if they were anybody else. But certainly with their lone loss just coming to Tennessee, that has me have them at number six right now. Just ahead of Oregon, just behind Clemson on my ballot. Justin, what about you? What did you think about it? And were there any other surprises that stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could definitely see the argument that TCU should be higher. At the same time, I mean, they also have had opposing quarterbacks go down, which, of course, is not their fault, not something that should necessarily be counted against them, but it does make the wins.
you're going to trigger OU fans here saying it's not their fault there with that.
But you know, I mean, that does play a role in some of those bigger wins that they've been able to have. I mean, other than that, I'm happy to see Tennessee at the top. They've been the team that I've been enjoying watching the most lately, just in terms of they continue to really surprise me and have continued to step up against some really good opponents. So yeah, those are just some of the main ones. Yeah, I'm kind of looking through the list here right now. Cool to see Tulane there at 19. I mean, they've also been a team that's been really surprising this season. Those are just a few things that are kind of catching my eye right now.
What about you, Barry? We talked about this a little bit on our way back home the other day, but, you know, I rank Tennessee number one. They come out number one in the committee's rankings, sort of a cool deal to see for Josh Heupel. Obviously, this weekend will shake up that top of the order. But, you know, what did you think about the way that the committee lined things out in the initial rankings? And I'll also say this, TCU is going to have a chance to move up, because if they're able to stay undefeated and ultimately win the Big 12, we've seen how the committee values conference championships versus, you know, a couple of those other teams ahead of them that aren't going to get a chance to win the title. I still think that TCU, if it wins, is pretty secure when it comes to the 14 playoff. But what did you make about the way the committee handled it overall, especially the way that they handled the Big 12 there with the four teams we see in there?
I didn't have a big problem other than two schools that haven't been mentioned in this current discussion, and that's Michigan and Ohio State. Everybody centered on Alabama and Clemson, but the committee's love of Ohio State continues year after year after year. The Buckeyes have beaten Notre Dame and Penn State, and yet, you know, they get ranked ahead of Georgia. I think that's nonsense, personally. TCU is going to be fine. The committee's rankings is not near as alarming to me as the comments after the ESPN show. Doesn't matter who's on the committee. Doesn't matter who the chairman is. Doesn't matter what teams we're talking about. The committee spokesman continues to just toss out this drivel year after year after year about balance and you know, the defense doesn't necessarily play all that well. Boo Corrigan yesterday said something about Georgia hasn't given up a first quarter touchdown all year or something. Who cares how many touchdowns you give up in the first quarter? This is just madness, talking about these minute statistics that don't mean anything. The committee has made it clear. If you win games with offense more than defense, they don't like you that much. Now, the one exception is if you beat Alabama, you've got their attention. So 52-49 Tennessee got their attention. But Ohio State apparently leads the nation in scoring defense. He sent me to the schedule. The Buckeyes have played Toledo, Arkansas State, Notre Dame, Wisconsin, Iowa,
Rutgers.
I mean, you know what? I've actually misspoken. Illinois leads the nation in he mentioned this. Illinois leads the nation in scoring defense, and that's one thing they like about them. Illinois has played literally teams that couldn't get to 22 points if you let them block three punts inside the five-yard line. I mean, it's just nonsense. And we might have to stop having these press conferences if the spokesman can't come up with better reasons. Just say we think Ohio State's better. We like beating Notre Dame and Penn State better than we like beating Oregon. Just say that. Don't give me this explosive offense, balanced defense stuff. TCU's defense has actually not been bad this year. They gave up 30 in regulation to Oklahoma State. They gave up 28 to Kansas State. That's pretty good defense. They're not playing Iowa. They're not playing Rutgers. They're playing people that can move the ball. So
if Illinois and Ohio State don't have some of the best defenses in the country, that should be a problem. The Big Ten stinks in offense.
Exactly. I mean, for crying out loud. So that's the kind of thing. This use of statistics, this idea that not every 7-point win is made equal, this idea that statistics are important in judging football teams. We have a way of determining who is better at football. It's called the scoreboard, and we have an elaborate scoring system. If that scoring system is flawed, that's what we need to change. We need to work on that more than worrying about this committee priorities. So hopefully it'll all shake out. I think if TCU wins out, they'll be in the playoff. I think if they don't win out, they won't be in the playoff. That's what I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I do think that they need to win out. But, Barry, I'm not sure if I want to do this again after the soapbox moment. But do you feel like that's the way the committee really goes about analyzing it? Or is it as simple as they rank their teams and then the chairman has to come up with an explanation for why team X is ahead of, team Y?
That's an outstanding question. I think the answer is probably a little bit of both. I've done the mock selection though, and there were guys in there that got worked up about how teams won a game. Some guy was the year, I think we looked at 2011 or something. I can't remember. But he's all fired up for Wisconsin because the Badgers had two losses and they'd lost both on Hail Marys. Well, I pointed out one of them was not a Hail Mary. One was a fourth down pass at the end of the game, but it's from the 30-yard line and it was a post pattern. But either way, do Hail Marys not count as full touchdowns? If those don't count, then let's present it on the scoreboard that way. So there is that line of thinking that not all wins are created equal and that kind of thing. But I do think sometimes the committee chairman faces pressure on how to answer questions. He's got to fill some time. People ask him, sort of like, why do you like pepperoni better than sausage? Well, if somebody asked me that question, I really couldn't answer it. But guess what? I do like pepperoni better than sausage. So, some things are not answerable. That's just what I think. So it is a little bit of a problem.
All right, Jenny, a couple questions for you. First of all, pepperoni or sausage?
Give me pepperoni.
That's a good choice. Can you defend your position?
Not really. And if the sausage lobby wants to come at me, I'll just say I like sausage at breakfast a whole lot. How's that for right toe on the line? Come right down the middle at you.
That works. But next question, we'll turn it to the last segment of this Spaces. How do you feel like this game on Saturday is going to play out? What are your keys and what's your prediction?
Who are we looking at? Who you want to talk? You want me to talk?
Well, I was asking Jenny.
We lose Jacko?
I think we did here.
Well, I can answer. Right. I can answer.
Right. Yeah, go ahead, Barry.
I think it's a tough game for OU. I think Baylor's pretty good. I think their offense is much better than it was last year, and they won the Big 12 last year. Their defense is not as good, but it's still not bad. I think it's going to be a very tough game for OU. I think both sides are going to have to play really well. I think Baylor probably wins this game.
Yeah, I think would you go with Baylor 28-27, I believe, in your pick, Barry?
I think that's what I said.
All right. And let's see. Jenny, are you back?
Yep, sorry about that. Yep, I'm here. Yeah, this is a tough one to pick. I agree. I think this is a game that's a one-possession game in my mind. Of course, I never would have guessed I was going to Manhattan, Kansas last week to see a blowout, so what do I know? But I got Baylor winning, and I've got them scoring a little bit more than Barry. I got 38-31 is my score. I think it could definitely be, in the 20s type of game. I think there's going to be some points scored, but I just like Baylor a little bit better. I think that defensive front can cause some havoc. So I think scoring as much as OU needs to score might be a problem. I think somebody said it earlier that, Sooners are probably going to have to just outscore the Bears. And I think Baylor's defense is good enough to keep that from happening. But, the history, Baylor's only won one time in Norman. So if you're looking for a reason to say the Bears go home with defeat, that's as good as any. I think it is going to be super close, though.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I'll wait a second to give my prediction after Justin. What do you got on Saturday?
Well, first off, let me say I'm more of a meat lovers person. I say expand the
Justin wants all the meats.
Yeah, there's room for both pepperoni and sausage if you expand the playoffs. That's my opinion. But I would probably go with also a very close one here. I'm going to give it to OU just with a slight edge. I think that Marvin Mims is due for a bigger game. I really like what we've seen out of the offensive line, which has helped Eric Radahl's have been playing really well as of late. Defense, of course, still going to be the question for OU. They've taken steps in the right direction, granted against not the best offenses so far, but it seems like this team in general has been progressing in the right direction the past few games. I think it's going to be a close one, but at home, I'll go ahead and give OU the 31-27 win.
Yeah, and I'm right there with you, Justin. I picked OU to win 34-31. I think it's really tight, one that goes down to the wire, but the fact that it's in Norman give the Sooners just a barely an edge in this one. I think OU has got to play well up front on both sides of the ball. They have to open up room for Eric Gray, protect Dylan Gabriel, and then on the other side, they've got to make Richard Reese work for everything that he gets on the ground there. But I think with some of the improvement that we've seen out of the Sooners the last few weeks, it's not perfect, but they're able to score enough to keep the Bears at bay and clinch bowl eligibility yet again when it looked like a few weeks ago that was going to be in question. So we'll see what happens on Saturday in Norman, Baylor, Oklahoma. That's a 2 p.m. kickoff on ESPN Plus. Will be interesting to see. Justin will actually have a story on the ESPN Plus angle of things and tomorrow's Oklahoman. Check that out. We'll see how the Sooners, if they're able to keep up that momentum there. We'll be back after the game with another edition of the Sooners Extra Twitter Spaces. Thank you so much for joining us on this Wednesday afternoon. Have a great week, and you can check out our work every day at Oklahoman.com and every morning in the Oklahoman for the best OU coverage anyway.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.